The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
But all of it brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin and Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95.
It's the story of your life. You're moving down the page. And you know you're on your way.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, candidates. Hugh Hewitt. The morning after the equivalent of the Red Wedding for budgets. I must tell you, if you're not a Game of Thrones fan, you will not know what happened at the end of season three of Game of Thrones. But it's the Red Wedding, famous in Game of Thrones lore, where Walder Frey kills the King of the North. And since I'm often called the King of the North of talk radio, that was before I became the Ted Lasso of talk radio. Yeah, I always think about the King of the North. I was just telling Adam before the show began that last night...
House Glover will stand behind House Stark... as we have for 1,000 years.
And I will stand behind Jon Snow.
The King in the North!
Yeah, that's what they say.
The King in the North!
The King of the North. Yes. That's what I hear whenever people see me on the way to the studio. But the first King of the North wasn't actually Jon Snow, it was Robb Stark. And he made the stop. He made the mistake of stopping at the twins for dinner and getting married and having a wedding reception. And how does this all tie in with Joe Biden? Well, last night I was watching Gangs of London before Joe Biden came on. And Gangs of London is not for the faint of heart. No, 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 no. Take the most violent television you've seen and combine it with the most violent television you've seen. And you've got the most violent television you've seen. But it's interesting. And I hope London doesn't really run that way. And one of the villains is played by David Bradley, who plays Walder Frey, who may be the worst guy in King of the in Games of Thrones. And he's also better known for playing Filch, Harry Potter's Filch. And so last night was the Red Wedding for budget because Joe Biden got up there. And I could do a couple of things. I could talk about what The Wall Street Journal does. Biden's Cradle to Grave Government is their editorial. Or other people are saying, my gosh, there isn't enough money in the world. Was he going to print another $2 trillion or the $2 trillion in taxes that are on the table? It was just a silly speech. It's just got no connection to reality. But what I object to most is the framing. You've got to hear how he said a lot of good things, a lot of dumb things. But the framing is hubristic and just frankly offensive to the people who lived through real disasters of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor and getting killed by the SDS in the 60s. Cut number 20.
I stand here tonight, one day shy of the 100th day of my administration. 100 days since I took the oath of office and lifted my hand off our family Bible and inherited a nation, we all did, that was in crisis. The worst pandemic in a century. The worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War.
Stop, stop. The economy was already roaring back to life because the judicious PPP and the two prior, there were four COVID relief bills last year, and the economy was just waiting to open up. Operation Warp Speed, Donald Trump's great achievement, had produced three vaccines, two vaccines in the United States, one in England, two of which were already widely distributed. And we all knew that. Just as with any other program, the acceleration of that program was ongoing and was going to take care of itself. and the crisis of democracy. Nobody hates January 6th more than I do. I'm the equal of anyone. Lots of people hate it as much as I do. And 800 radicals, all of whom should be tried and convicted if juries agree of their various sins. It was a terrible day. It could have been a lot worse, but it wasn't 9/11. It wasn't Pearl Harbor. It wasn't the SDS bombings of the 1960s or the Radical Weather Underground. It wasn't. It just isn't. Please don't tell me that it was. It's not. Trying to set yourself up as FDR. I mean, and Joe Biden said, I'm sure he's playing this movie. But history is going to look at that and say, gosh, are you crazy? What in the world are you talking about? So the one part I liked about it, he did talk about China a little bit, and he's got some clarity here. Let's play cut 16.
We can't be so busy competing with one another that we forget the competition that we have with the rest of the world to win the 21st century. Secretary Blinken can tell you, I spent a lot of time with President Xi. Traveled over 17,000 miles with him. Spent, they tell me, over 24 hours in private discussions with him. When he called to congratulate him, we had a two-hour discussion. He's deadly earnest about becoming the most significant, consequential nation in the world. He and others, autocrats, think that democracy can't compete in the 21st century with autocracies because it takes too long to get consensus. To win that competition for the future, in my view, we also need to make a once-in-a-generation investment in our families and our children.
We already did that. We spent $6 trillion. We do not need to make any more ones. Did you see the numbers on Wall Street yesterday? Did you see what Apple did, what Facebook did, what Google did earlier in the week? Amazon reports today, and I own Amazon. I hope they have the same kind of quarter. Our investment infrastructure is terrific. We just have to get government out of the way and go back to the blue-collar boom that Donald Trump had going a year ago before the pandemic hit the United States, January of 2020. We were in such great shape. January and February of 2020 were in such great shape. And we'll go back there, but not if we re-regulate. And we will not. We will not compete with China if we raise the level of debt and interest rates climb because of inflationary pressures, which are already building. Joe Biden, cut number 17.
I kept my commitment to convene a climate summit right here in America.
Did any of you care? Really? Is anybody there driving to work right now? And you can call me, 1-800-520-1234. And guys, let anybody through. All right. Anyone who wants to tell me that the climate summit mattered a great deal. I don't care if they've been drinking, or if they've been up all night, or they're one of the lunatics who are on our X list. And we have an X list of people we just don't let on the air. You can let them on. If they want to make the argument that the climate summit actually was an important event, please let them on. 1-800-520-1234. Because that's just crazy. Nobody watched. Nobody cares. Nobody believes it. And China's laughing at you. But let's go back to Joe Biden's understanding of reality. Cut 17.
I kept my commitment to convene a climate summit right here in America with all the major economies of the world, China, Russia, India, European Union. And I said I'd do it in my first 100 days. I want to be very blunt about it. I had my attempt was to make sure that the world could see there was a consensus, that we are at an inflection point in history. The consensus is if we act to save the planet, we can create millions of jobs and economic growth and opportunity to raise the standard of living amongst everyone around the world. If you watched any of it and you were all busy, I'm sure you didn't have much time. That's what virtually every nation said, even the ones that aren't doing their fair share. The investments I proposed tonight also advance the foreign policy, in my view, that benefits the middle class. That means making sure every nation plays by the same rules in the global economy, including China. In my discussion with President Xi, I told him, we welcome the competition. We're not looking for conflict. But I made absolutely clear that we will defend America's interest across the board. America will stand up to unfair trade practices that undercut American workers and American industries, like subsidies from state to state-owned operations and enterprises, and the theft of American technology and intellectual property. I also told President Xi that we'll maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific, just as we do with NATO in Europe.
Not to start President Biden. Eric in California. Good morning, Eric. Or did he go away? I thought he had come through. I'm really eager for anyone who watched the climate summit to tell me what they took away from it, because President Biden thinks it's the key achievement of his first 100 days. When we come back, by the way, Tim Scott gave a great speech, and I'll play that for you in segments 2, 3, and 4 after I do a market update. Generally speaking, big swing and a miss last night. But again, what were you expecting? I mean, the budget red wedding. But other than that, what were you expecting? It's not going to pass. Congress doesn't want to lose their job. Democrats over there are now starting to raise money and not get any money up. Eric in California went away. Turns out he didn't really watch the climate summit. Stay tuned, America. Nobody did. It had worse ratings than the Oscars, which is pretty hard to do. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I normally don't play bread bumps, but my friend Captain Mark Vandroff is a bread aficionado, and he and I are talking about football, and I have to correct them all the time about college football, and when I do that, I feel bad, and so I play from his playlist. I have an actual Vandroff playlist, which if I did, I would lose my audience, Captain, Tennille. It's a playlist that's just so very, very unique to Captain Vandroff. And he's a big bread guy, and that's okay. We don't mind that. But Florida football, spare me. All right, Tim Scott gave a speech last night after President Biden delivered his. And Senator Scott of South Carolina begins, and you should listen to this, Cut 18.
Good evening. I'm Senator Tim Scott from the great state of South Carolina. We just heard President Biden's first address to Congress. Our president seems like a good man. His speech was full of good words, but President Biden promised you a specific kind of leadership. He promised to unite a nation, to lower the temperature, to govern for all Americans, no matter how we voted. This was the pitch. You just heard it again. But our nation is starving for more than empty platitudes. We need policies and progress that brings us closer together. But 3 months in, the actions of the president and his party are pulling us further and further apart. I won't waste your time with finger pointing or partisan bickering. You can get that on TV anytime you want. I want to have an honest conversation about common sense and common ground, about this feeling that our nation is sliding off its shared foundation and how we move forward together. Growing up, I never dreamed I would be standing here tonight. When I was a kid, my parents divorced. My mother, my brother, and I moved in with my grandparents. Three of us sharing one bedroom. I was disillusioned and angry, and I nearly failed out of school. But I was blessed. First with a praying mama. And let me say this to the single mothers out there who are working their tails off, working hard, trying to make the ends meet, wondering if it's worth it. You can bet it is. God bless your amazing effort on part of your kids. I was also blessed by a Chick-fil-A operator, John Moniz. And finally, with a string of opportunities that are only possible here in America. This past year, I've watched COVID attack every rung of the ladder that helped me up. So many families have lost parents and grandparents too early. So many small businesses have gone under. Becoming a Christian transformed my life, but for months, too many churches were shut down. Most of all, I'm saddened that millions of kids have lost a year of learning when they could not afford to lose a single day. Locking vulnerable kids out of the classroom is locking adults out of their future. Our public schools should have reopened months ago. Other countries did. Private and religious schools did. Science has shown for months that schools are safe. But too often, powerful grown-ups set science aside, and kids like me were left behind. The clearest case I've seen for school choice in our lifetimes, because we know that education is the closest thing to magic in America. Last year, under Republican leadership, we passed 5 bipartisan COVID packages. Congress supported our schools, our hospitals, saved our economy, and funded Operation Warp Speed, delivering vaccines in record time. All 5 bills got 90 votes in the Senate. Common sense found common ground. In February, Republicans told President Biden, we wanted to keep working together to finish this fight. But Democrats wanted to go it alone. They spent almost $2 trillion on a partisan bill that the White House bragged was the most liberal bill in American history. Only 1% went to vaccinations, no requirement to reopen schools promptly. COVID brought Congress together 5 times. This administration pushed us apart. Another issue that should unite us is infrastructure. Republicans support everything you think of when you think of infrastructure. Roads, bridges, ports, airports, waterways, high-speed broadband. We're in for all of that. But again, Democrats want a partisan wish list. They won't even build bridges to build bridges. Less than 6% of the president's plan goes to roads and bridges. It's a liberal wish list of big government waste, plus the biggest job-killing tax hikes in a generation. Experts say when all is said and done, it would lower wages of the average American worker and shrink our economy. Tonight, we also heard about a so-called family plan, even more taxing, even more spending, to put Washington even more in the middle of your life, from the cradle to college. The beauty of the American dream is that families get to define it for themselves. We should be expanding opportunities and options for all families, not throwing money at certain issues because Democrats think they know best. Infrastructure spending that shrinks our economy is not common sense. Weakening our southern borders and creating a crisis is not compassionate. The president is also abandoning principles he's held for decades. Now he says your tax dollars should fund abortions. He's laying groundwork to pack the Supreme Court. This is not common ground. Nowhere do we need common ground more desperately than in our discussions of race. I have experienced the pain of discrimination. I know what it feels like to be pulled over for no reason, to be followed around a store while I'm shopping. I remember every morning at the kitchen table, my grandfather would open the newspaper and read it, I thought. But later I realized he had never learned to read it. He just wanted to set the right example. I've also experienced a different kind of intolerance. I get called Uncle Tom and the N-word by progressives, by liberals. Just last week, a national newspaper suggested my family's poverty was actually privilege, because a relative owned land generations before my time. Believe me, I know firsthand, our healing is not finished. In 2015, after the shooting of Walter Scott, I wrote a bill to fund body cameras. Last year, after the deaths of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, I built an even bigger police reform proposal. But my Democratic colleagues blocked it. I extended an olive branch. I offered amendments. But Democrats used a filibuster to block the debate from even happening. My friends across the aisle seemed to want the issue more than they wanted a solution. But I'm still working. I'm hopeful that this will be different. When America comes together, we've made tremendous progress, but powerful forces want to pull us apart. 100 years ago, kids in classrooms were taught the color of their skin was their most important characteristic. And if they looked a certain way, they were inferior. Today, kids are being taught that the color of their skin defines them again. And if they look a certain way, they're an oppressor. From colleges to corporations to our culture, people are making money and gaining power by pretending we haven't made any progress at all. By doubling down on the divisions we've worked so hard to heal. You know this stuff is wrong. Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country. It's backwards to fight discrimination with different types of discrimination. And it's wrong to try to use our painful past to dishonestly shut down debates in the present. I'm an African-American who's voted in the South my entire life. I take voting rights personally. Republicans support making it easier to vote and harder to cheat. And so do the voters. Big majorities of Americans support early voting, and big majorities support voter ID, including African Americans and Hispanics. Common sense makes common ground. But today, this conversation has collapsed. The state of Georgia passed a law that expands early voting, preserves no-excuse mail-in voting, and despite what the president claimed, did not reduce election day hours. If you actually read this law, it's mainstream. It will be easier to vote early in Georgia than in Democrat-run New York. But the left doesn't want you to know that. They want people virtue signaling by yelling about a law they haven't even read. Fact checkers have called out the White House for misstatements. The president absurdly claims that this is worse than Jim Crow. What is going on here? I'll tell you, a Washington power grab. This misplaced outrage is supposed to justify Democrats' new sweeping bill that would take over elections for all 50 states. It would send public funds to political campaigns you disagree with and make the bipartisan Federal Elections Commission partisan. This is not about civil rights or our racial past. It's about rigging elections in the future. And no, the same filibuster that President Obama and President Biden praised when they were senators, the same filibuster that the Democrats used to kill my police reform bill last year, has not suddenly become a racist relic just because the shoe is now on the other foot. Race is not a political weapon to settle every issue the way one side wants. It's far too important. This should be a joyful springtime for our nation. This administration inherited a tide that had already turned. The coronavirus is on the run. Thanks to Operation Warp Speed in the Trump administration, our country is flooded with safe and effective vaccines. Thanks to our bipartisan work last year, job openings are rebounding. So why do we feel so divided? Anxious. A nation with so much cause for hope should not feel so heavy laden. A president who promised to bring us together should not be pushing agendas that tear us apart.
Pause right there. We'll come back and listen to the rest of Tim Scott's terrific speech last night. Senator Scott, 55-year-old senator from South Carolina, elected twice to the United States Senate after being originally appointed by Nikki Haley, is clearly, he said he's going to run for re-election in 2022. He'll win. And then, who knows? Who knows? Welcome back, America. I tell you every week, the most interesting political scene in the world is in Israel, which is why I'm addicted to it. It's just the craziest thing. And Michael Oren joins us each week from Israel. He's the former U.S. Israeli ambassador to the United States. He's also become a novelist. I did not know that, Dr. Oren. When does the new novel arrive?
It arrives on May 11th, To All Who Call in Truth.
To All Who Call in Truth. To All Who Call in Truth.
Psalm 45.
Okay, I will.
To All Who Call in Truth.
I will read it, and we will do a book interview about it. But let's do the news of the week, because I haven't read To All Who Call in Truth yet. First thing at the top of the headline, former Secretary of State, now Special Envoy on Climate, John Kerry, made the news this week. What'd you make of that report that he was telling Iran's foreign minister about Israeli strikes in Syria against Iranian assets?
You know, I worked with John Kerry for many years, both as Secretary of State, when he was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, worked with him, liked him, had a good rapport. But he's a deeply ideological man. When he conducted peace negotiations here between Israel and the Palestinians bolted the talks, John Kerry gave over an hour-long speech condemning Israel and condemning our settlement policy. By the way, this is a time cue when 500,000 Syrians were being massacred a couple hours' drive from where I'm talking to you, and John Kerry didn't say anything, all right? Didn't do anything, didn't say anything. Well, the greatest crime in the world was a couple hundred Israelis building some apartments in areas that they consider their homeland, okay? Think about that. And then the Iran nuclear deal, and the Secretary of State is up on this stage with the foreign minister of a country which is the most repressive regime in the world, which has sworn to destroy my country, commit genocide. And John Kerry's up there smiling. It's the greatest thing in the world. And so, you know, isn't the truth of telling the Iranians things? I mean, just on the basis of that behavior alone, I would have reason not to discard it immediately.
Okay, let me ask you about something. Joby Warrick, Washington Post reporter, has a new book on the Obama era called The Red Line. I have it here. I talked to Joby for an hour. It's at my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, The Unraveling of Syria and America's Race to Destroy the Most Dangerous Arsenal in the World. Joby's won two Pulitzers. He's maybe the best national security and foreign affairs reporter in America.
Very fine reporter.
A damning indictment of John Kerry and President Obama and their Syria policy. You cannot help but put this down and say, wow, did those guys and that group screw 500,000 Syrians who are dead and 2 million more who are refugees in a repressive Assad regime which remains in control of a WMD arsenal that threatens Israel every day. I mean, there's no other conclusion to reach.
I certainly didn't reach a conclusion. what is so mystifying to me, Hugh, is why this administration is so set on revisiting this horrible mistake. But
With the fanatics' belief, they believe that there are moderates in Iran who will rise when Khamenei dies, and they're wrong. Now, Michael, we've only got a couple of minutes. What do you think is going to happen here? I can't make heads or tail out of the Israeli political negotiation.
Well, I've said it week after week. We're probably heading to a fifth election, and that's good for Netanyahu. If he doesn't lose, he wins, right? I can always compare him to some of our enemies in Gaza. If he doesn't lose, he wins. He goes for another 5-6 months. But there's an outside chance that the opposing camp, the anti-Netanyahu camp, which is made up of rightists, leftists, people up and down, and religious and secular, will somehow get together and put together an alternative coalition. And their turn is coming up because Netanyahu's time limit that the president gives him to put together a government is coming to an end next week. So they'll have that opportunity. I'm not particularly, sanguine about it. I don't think that their chances are great, but they can bridge the gaps between them in the anti-BB camp. And we could well be going to a fifth election, which is, again, it's very bad for this country. I must tell you, I can't, sugarcoat it in any way. The public confidence in politicians and in our political system is at an all-time low. And people aren't taking the government seriously. We don't have budgets. We didn't even have a justice minister until yesterday, so we couldn't even implement our laws. Yeah, we are in a governmental democratic crisis right now.
And you also have rockets flying from Gaza. We only have 30 seconds, but do you expect that to fade so we don't have to have a major conflict on the Israeli-Gaza border?
Yeah, but that actually has nothing to do with us. It has to do with the Palestinian elections. And Hamas is going to be running against Mahmoud Abbas of the Fatah Party, and they want to show that they're tough, so they fire some rockets at us. And it's also Ramadan, so they're celebrating. So that has absolutely nothing to do with us, but our ability to deal with it is hamstrung by the absence of a truly cohesive and stable government.
Well, I hope that comes to a conclusion very quickly. Do you expect to run yourself in a fifth round of elections, Dr. Oren?
I always say you possibly. Right now, I want to talk to you and advance my novel.
Okay, the novel comes out on May 11th. It's pre-ordering. I will read it. We will have a long conversation for the podcast, and I recommend to everyone Michael Oren's book of short stories, The Night Archer. Truly terrific, truly wonderful writing. I look forward to your novel. Michael, be well. And I tell everyone, if you missed my conversation with Joby Warrick yesterday, the interview with Hugh Hewitt is a podcast that's available at iTunes. I do two podcasts. One is called The Hugh Hewitt Show, Highly Condensed Hugh. That's a daily compression of the three-hour show into about 45 minutes to an hour. And then the interview with Hugh Hewitt, as was yesterday's with Joby Warrick, is my very best stuff, long form, with people like Joby who know what they're doing. You've got to go listen to that one. Head over during the break to iTunes or Spotify or the Salem Podcast Network and download and listen to Joby Warrick and Hugh Hewitt talking about his book, Red Line. Come back for hour two of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt here. Coming up later this hour, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina joins me. His Madison County Republican speech of a fortnight ago lit up this audience, so I tracked him down. He joins us. But first, the wayward son of Minnesota, James Homan, joins me of the Washington Post. And I know your game, you rogue. You didn't show up yesterday after the Indians had clobbered the Twins, and now you show up after the Twins have clobbered the Indians. I know your game. I've got your game. I know your number.
Well, we'll see how the series finishes.
Yeah, well, we know that, too. Now, look, President Biden spoke last night. I want to get your thoughts on that just generally first. What did you think of the speech, and what do you think of the response?
Well, it's the longest speech Biden's given in some time, and it really did feel like a frontal assault on Reaganism, you know, the making a very vocal case for big government, higher taxes, and, you know, declaring that trickle-down economics has never worked and it never will. I thought it was a pretty clear statement of his view of government.
It is the most left-wing speech ever delivered by a president on policy grounds, by a nice man, and I have no doubt that he is one. The only time I've ever interviewed him, he was the nicest guy in the room. But I want to play for you the single most objectionable thing I found in the speech. The economics are like the Red Wedding economics. Everybody's dead at the end of it. There's blood on the ground. The budget is slain, and we're in full revolt against ordinary economic theory. But this is what I object to. Cut number 20.
I stand here tonight, one day shy of the 100th day of my administration. 100 days since I took the oath of office and lifted my hand off our family Bible and inherited a nation, we all did, that was in crisis. The worst pandemic in a century. The worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War.
Okay. Now, Homan, you're a Stanford guy, so you may not know much history. But what do you think of that statement?
Well, I know where he was trying to go, and I know that kind of prima facie that obviously is not the case.
Okay. Prima facie, it's a dumb thing. Let me play for you. George W. Bush, cut the next cut, gentlemen.
We are here in the middle hour of our grief. So many have suffered so great a loss, and today we express our nation's sorrow.
This was at the National Cathedral in the middle of the 9/11 week. I remember it. Well, I think it's the finest president's speech I've ever heard. And here is something W said that everyone will remember. Now, James Homan, you're a young man. Do you remember 9/11?
I actually vividly remember that particular moment, and it always gives me chills, the bullhorn moment.
Well, I was on the air for 10 hours that day, and I believe a lot of the politics of America reflect the post-traumatic stress of a country following 9/11 that had never been attacked on its homeland. I really do. I can't believe Joe Biden said that last night. And it was in his prepared text, by the way. It was not freelancing. Right. What is wrong with his speechwriting crew? Do you know who wrote that speech?
I don't. I mean, it's probably young people. and it is. I mean, there's so much myopia in the short term, you know, thinking and lack of perspective in the grand sweep of history. I will say, obviously, January 6th, terrible. And it is this, you know, when you're on Capitol Hill, you feel that, the body hasn't really recovered. But it's important to keep that in the broader perspective.
It is. And now I'm 65, so I can remember waking up and hearing my mom crying and listening to Bobby Kennedy being assassinated, Roman Catholics in Ohio saying, what, that after Martin Luther King and the SDS bombing and Vietnam scaring the living daylights, 52,000 Americans dead. I can't stand this revisionism stuff. I don't mind him saying, we had a rough year. We did. 500,000 Americans are dead, and COVID is responsible for most of that, and it's a plague on the world, and it's killing India. I don't mind talking about that, but the economy was fine in January. Operation Warp Speed had produced the vaccine. Does anyone believe this stuff, James? I mean, around the Washington Post newsroom, do people say, yeah, that was the worst thing ever. We were in the darkest, deepest well we've ever been in. It's just nonsense.
Yeah, and it is interesting. I think like the first half of this, the country's just so polarized that it is really remarkable that, you know, Biden's approval rating, while slightly better than Trump at this point, is significantly lower than Obama's was, and it is striking that like the percentage of Republicans and Democrats who strongly approve or disapprove is like off the charts. It took Obama 3 years to have the kind of strong disapproval level that Biden has now, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it. I think that the first half of that speech, again, longest speech he's given in a very long time, was aimed at sort of the, I think, Obama-Trump voters, kind of blue-collar, you know, people in the Midwest, and trying to, like, create this comeback narrative. And then I think the second half of the speech was a liberal wish list, check the box exercise, going through a bunch of really, you know, big liberal priorities that are never going to actually pass. And so it, in that way, it felt like two different speeches.
Okay, write this down, James. He's the Music Man president. And I don't know if you even get that reference. Do you get that reference?
I do.
He is the Music Man president, and it's not going to work. You cannot do that to the American people. They will not buy it. Your hard left progs are applauding, and the rest of us are saying, wait a minute, economics has not been repealed. You can't print this much money. Now, I want to ask you about one of your colleagues, Joby Warrick. Have you gotten to spend much time with Joby?
I have.
He's an amazing reporter. I've never met him in person. I've just done long interviews with him. I spent an hour with him yesterday talking about his book, Red Line, The Unraveling of Syria and America's Race to Destroy the Most Dangerous Arsenal in the World. I want everyone to listen to the podcast of that at the interview with Hugh Hewitt. He and I talked about the media at the end of that and the fact that the especially younger media, and this is directed at you and your colleagues who are younger, just don't report anymore. They are participants in the game. Now, I have been a participant in the game for the 30 years I've been doing that, but he is very worried about that trend. And I saw it on Twitter last night. I saw it this morning. Do you agree with him that Twitter has turned most of your generation into players and not reporters? I mean, you are reporters, but you're also players.
I worry that there is too much of that. I agree with Joby's impulse there. And I do think part of it is that, you know, when Joby was coming of age, you would be, you know, you really were just kind of an anonymous person who was part of an institution like the Washington Post. And now you have a lot of people who don't see it that way because of social media, because they have cable contracts, because of everything else. And so, and I think that there's definitely a tension within the media where you have kind of a certain kind of person who wants to, you know, speak out and essentially, you know, have almost an activist view. And then you have a lot of more, I think the lion's share actually, more traditionalist people who share the same fundamental values and approach as Joby. I'd put myself in that category.
I do, too. That's why I asked you. And I think, unfortunately, cable news is driving this. And their numbers are plummeting, by the way, and it's terrible for the country. But there are some programmers. These are economically driven decisions that monetize polarization. And cable channels that want 100% of the 3% on the left or right, as opposed to the Hugh Hewitt show, which wants 5% of the 100%. And that's a huge different orientation to want 100% of the 3% on the left or the right, as opposed to 5% of the 100%. And the Post wants 5% of the 100%. Now it wants 10% of the 100%. It might want 20%. I mean, all of the big platforms left. But we're not going to get there unless we get a fact check of that speech and a fact check of that claim. That claim is offensive. That claim is wrong. And I'll give you the last word. The 9/11 people out there who died and everyone who's gone through the war and been to Iraq and Afghanistan or 1,000 other places, it's just offensive, James. Last word to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about your kind of diagnosis of the media, and I think it is, you know, it skews incentives and everything. I think, you know, I actually was kind of troubled by a lot of the talk about Afghanistan, and it does kind of, it felt like some of those sound bites from last night will end up being chilling to watch again in 5 or 10 years when the Taliban have taken over.
If they take over, I am praying they do not take over. It's the end of women's liberation and women's education and women's health care in Afghanistan again, if that happens. So pray that it doesn't. James, good to talk to you. As always, stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Just wrapped up a terrific interview with Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina. It will be at my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, shortly. I'm welcoming now Senator Steve Daines of the great state of Montana. Welcome back, Senator Daines. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Hugh. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Montana scored a new House seat this week from the Census Bureau. That's going to make it complicated in Montana for the first time ever to run for House. You're going to have to decide which district you're in.
You know, Hugh, when I was growing up in Montana, we used to have two members of Congress divided east and west. In fact, that goes back to 1909 up until 1992, and then we lost the seat, but we got it back. We're the first state to ever lose a seat and get a seat back. But it's a good thing because I believe that if D.C. can look a little bit more like Montana, that's a good thing for our country.
Yeah, but all the Californians are moving out there, and it scares me. I've spent time with our mutual friend Jan Genera up at his house in Montana on the Ennis, fishing out the Madison River, and I'm worried that you got too many Golden Staters going to Montana. Are you worried about they're going to vote the way they voted in California when they get to Montana?
I do, but here's an interesting phenomenon, Hugh. What we are seeing is, in some cases, refugees who are leaving tyranny and big government. They're tired of what's happening in California, in Washington, Oregon, even Colorado, and they're seeking more freedom, and they're coming to Montana. So the numbers we're looking at suggest the mix might actually be people who are fleeing and want to leave the ideologies of those states versus bring it with them. So we got to keep an eye on it. But that's, you know, we saw a massive red wave in Montana in the 2020 election. We swept every seat, and so I think it shows you that we've got hopefully the right kind of thinking coming into Montana. Not always, but I think more often than not.
Now, I just told Lieutenant Governor Robinson, I know how legacy media works, and if they listen to this interview, they'll say that California's a tyranny, and we know that that's good rhetoric, but it's not true. It's just a crazy, dysfunctional, broken state. I want to ask you about, though, last night. Lieutenant Governor Robinson said, had he been in the room when President Biden said January 6th was the worst threat to democracy since the Civil War, he would have walked out conspicuously. That is a crazy statement. It is an ahistorical, crazy statement that ignores 9/11, Pearl Harbor. Lieutenant Governor Robinson threw in the sinking of the Lusitania and Jim Crow. What did you make of that? What is your old colleague Joe Biden up to?
Oh, I tell you, I'm still trying to process what I heard last night and thinking about what was once the far left fringe of the Democrat Party is truly now front and center. You know, the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC ideology, that's now in charge. It was breathtaking. You know, the $6 trillion, Hugh, in new spending proposals. These are just massive spending increases. Of course, the higher taxes, doubling cap gains rates, more gun control, free preschool and community college, the Green New Deal. Hugh, I mean, I thought to myself, this is making Barack Obama sound like Ronald Reagan when you think about comparisons. It just was absolutely stunning. But I'll give him credit. they're not trying to hide their socialist radical agenda anymore. They came right out in the open here and laid it all out for us, and we saw it clearly in what the president shared last night.
Now, Senator, unless basic economics, whatever school you're in, whether you're the Chicago school or Keynesian or whatever, you can't print this much money. I approve what you did last year, the COVID relief bills. I salute Leader McConnell and everyone behind PPP. I understood what needed to be done. And the $2 trillion that they just blew on, when it was a big party and we're all going to have a hangover. But if they do what he wanted last night, we're going to have Argentinian-style inflation here.
No doubt about it. What we're seeing, you're already starting to see the out in the storm clouds gathering on the horizon of the inflationary forces that are going to hit this economy. This is something that I was questioning Jay Powell about when he came through the banking committee here recently. You cannot push this massive spending. Hugh, we're throwing around the word trillions like we used to talk about billions. And just when you think about the entire federal budget, both discretionary and mandatory spending to fund all of government, all entitlements, all the military, is about $4.5 trillion a year. They want to add $6 trillion on top of that in new spending. And never mind, there was about $4 trillion of COVID relief passed last year. So these numbers, you add it all up, it's $10 trillion. Four last year, $6 trillion of more spending. That's $10 trillion over the course of last year and this year.
Well, it's going to be a hell of a good year. Every asset class is going to pop as we see home sales are popping, as we see the stock market popping. But the bill to be paid there is eventually the cost of everything goes up. And we haven't had inflation in so long. You're not old enough to have bought a house at 12.5% or 13% 30-year interest like I did when my wife and I bought our first house in 1985. But it is not a good thing. Inflation is a destroyer of lives.
Well, there's a number of compounding factors here as well. Not only all the money is being printed, but if you look at the CPI numbers that came out in February, half of the inflationary pressures here were energy related. And so when you combine the massive spending plus the Green New Deal, it's going to put pressure here on oil, natural gas, just energy prices in general. This used to be comparative advantage for us here to beat China long term because of our energy independence. He is moving us down the path. You and I remember 1973, dependencies on the Middle East, War of Yom Kippur, oil prices quadruple, a 30-year fixed mortgage, Hugh, in 1981, right when Reagan got on board, was 18.6%. And we have a generation that does not understand what happens with inflation and interest rates and how that absolutely destroys an economy, frankly, destroys families.
When you look at your colleagues in the Senate dining room, and I've had lunch up there before, and I know you folks all get together and get along fine, and they're Bible studies, and everybody's a human being, and nobody wants to screw up. But honestly, do they not get that? Do they not understand what they're unleashing on this country? And it will destroy poor people. It's poor people and old people on fixed incomes especially who are crushed by inflation. It worked your whole life to be 80 years old with a pension and happy, and all of a sudden you cannot buy food.
Think about it, Hugh. When you're living on a fixed income, you are looking at – what are you looking at? You're looking at taxes. You're looking at your utility bill. And then, just overall in inflation. And what Biden is doing and the left is absolutely an attack on the working class of this country. When you look back at what we did when we cut taxes in 2017, we saw real wage growth for the working class folks of America. And again, that's always what socialism – and far-left ideology promises you're going to help the working class. And you know what really happens, Hugh? History repeats itself over and over again. It's the elites that prosper, and the working class are hurt.
You know, Rahm Emanuel is being tipped to be the ambassador to Japan. And his most famous quote, which defines Democratic Party politics forever, is never let a crisis go to waste. Yeah. And the COVID crisis is a real crisis. It's so terrible right now in India, and I'm glad we're helping India out. It was bad in the United States. It's like going to be far worse in India. Mm-hmm. But they're not letting this crisis go to waste, Senator Daines. They are definitely not letting it go to waste.
Well, there's two words they use crisis with, the COVID crisis and the climate crisis, what they use. And that's just it's classic playbook out of Rahm Emanuel, isn't it? It's take a crisis, blow it up, and use that as rationale here to drive big government. I mean, think about it. It was just a few months ago We had every Senate seat filled in the Senate chamber here with the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Nobody was worried about having 100 senators in the Senate chamber. And when it comes time now for this joint session address, you had this sparsely populated House chamber, I think, to try to send this message of this crisis and why we got to have big government here to come to the rescue. But that's such a contradiction around why, you know, I wasn't allowed to go to the joint session last night because they had limited seating.
Now, you know, Senator, last question. I'm old enough to remember the Music Man, and I tell everyone Joe Biden is the Music Man president. When I saw Vice President Harris and Speaker Pelosi in masks, I said to myself, this is theater. This is absolute theater. They're both vaccinated. They don't have to be near anyone. They can put the masks on at the end as they make their way out of the building on the unlikely chance there's anybody near them who could infect them, and they're an outbreak case. They're both vaccinated. What in the world? It's the craziest messaging. What is going on with these people?
Well, all I got to tell you, Hugh, when I jump on an airplane in Montana and fly back to D.C., there's a lot of anxiousness and concern about where this country's headed. But when I get on the plane and go back to Montana, I'm headed back to freedom. We have a new governor, Greg Gianforte. He's been a friend of mine for 25 years. We were in business together. You've got these common sense Republican governors. He lifted the mask mandate. We've got a 3.8% unemployment rate in Montana. We're doing great. We're focused on personal responsibility, getting the vaccines out. And I tell you, elections matter, Hugh. Thank God we got Greg Gianforte as our governor. And it's just tragic what's happening right here in Washington.
November 2022 can't come fast enough to repudiate all of this. And I mean a huge repudiation. Senator Steve Daines of the great state of Montana, I promise you I will not fish out the Madison again. Jan Janura wants me to, but I will leave it alone for the other fishermen in the great state of Montana. Stay tuned, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Now, we got to slow down for the Steelers fans out there who don't know what a podcast is. But in the world of podcasting, I want to introduce you to the Clegane brothers. One of them is the Mountain and one of them is the Hound. I'm not sure which is which, but Comfortably Smug and Josh Holmes are combining to make the Ruthless podcast a must-listen-to podcast. They have been barons of social media, but they've made their play. They're going for the throne of podcasting as we speak. The minions have been unleashed. They have overrun my tribbles. The Holmes is in the back commanding the reserve force. Welcome, gentlemen. I'm glad to have you both. Let me start with you, Josh, because Smug is he's just not going to be understood by the Steelers fans. What are you up to, and who are you guys, and what are the minions?
Well, this is awesome. We appreciate the invite here, Hugh. We're just trying to pick up the water and carry it a little further. You've been doing this for years, but we started a podcast. It's called Ruthless, and we started last October. I think we thought it was going to be like a 3 or 4 week project to kind of focus some conservative minds at the end of an election, and it kind of popped to the top of the charts, and we figured now we've got an obligation. So here we are 7 months later.
Hey, Smug, you know, this is Game of Thrones in the world of podcasting. You're either on top or you're falling down the mountain. So you guys have made a bid for the throne. How's it going? What do the minions think?
Well, first off, I have to say that's probably the best introduction I have ever received in my life. Thank you so much for having us on the show.
It's like Josh said, this kind of became kind of like a phenomenon, like bottle of lightning that just took off. Our first episode ended up being, I think, NPR's political podcast. The first week it was out, we went right to the top of the charts. And so, you know, we've got over 400,000 unique listeners at this point, and we've reached the top 1% of all podcasts on earth of any subject. So the enthusiasm has been incredible. We're so grateful to our listeners, grateful for you having us on the show. And we really want to make sure we hold the line, we get the message out, and we win back the House, the Senate, and we make sure that conservatives are heard across the country.
Well, I hope you guys have dragons because, Charlie Kirk's going to fight back against you. Charlie is kind of our Red Viper. And so in the world of podcasting, the old guys like me, we do our job. But this is not our fight. This is the young people's fight. Josh, give us some background on you. I know Smug stays behind the curtain, but you don't. We know your past. Tell people who you work for and why you're good at what you do.
Yeah, well, it's nice of you. I was Leader McConnell's chief of staff for a series.
Bingo.
Ran his campaign and worked on the inside. I mean, I think that's kind of what makes our partnership with Smug and I work, is I've had sort of an insider perspective on a lot of this for years. And like the one thing I think has been totally missing from conservative discussion, you do a great job of keeping it light, Hugh, but I think the vast majority of conservatives don't have enough fun while they're talking about politics.
100% agree. Yeah. And when you've worked for Machiavelli, you kind of know what's in the prints, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. But, we like to keep it light. We like to have fun, laugh, self-deprecation, all the stuff that has sort of been missing from the conservative side that we feel like we're sort of filling a void with. But, providing some decent information, too. And I think that's just really important. When you live in such a fake news culture, getting accurate information out to people who actually care about this stuff is super important.
And, Smug, I gotta pay you a compliment. The Minions stuff. Mark Germain, back in the ancient days of radio in 1990 when he was Mr. KFI, Mr. KABC, he used to refer to his Minions, and I always thought it was brilliant, and so I just ripped it off and called them Tribbles from Star Trek. But your Minions, dude, when you unleash the Horde, it really is like the people who live north of the Wall heading south. It's just crazy. Where did they come from? Who are they? And why do you do what you do, and who are you to the extent you want to tell us?
Sure. Well, to start with, the Minions are the most incredible and diverse and talented group of people you could ever hope to assemble. I've pre-COVID, I would tour the country. We would have meetups. I'm currently in Miami. We've had a couple Minion meetups where we had folks who actually flew in just to hang out, then flew back out. We had people who drove 4 hours from North Florida to hang out. These are just incredibly engaged and motivated people. And I've always said the thing about the Minions is it's not about me. I want them to, it's all about them building communities, knowing each other, because I think a big part, especially right now with how slanted the media coverage is, conservatives need to know that actually the majority of the country stands with us. We've just been bullied into thinking we're not allowed to say and think what we feel. And when you have the Minions engage online and then in person with each other, it's like a light bulb goes off that, hey, you know what? There's so many other people who agree with my principles and values. And we have a actual grassroots movement at this point where, the power of persuasion that comes down and that can be brought to bear on issues that can respond to the left, whether it be, them pushing these Looney Tunes ideas like the Green New Deal or packing the court. They get a response in real time from the Minions. It's incredible.
I have not seen anything like the explosion of Ruthless and U2 since Rush's Rush to Excellence tour, which you probably are both too young to remember. And out of nowhere, Rush was showing up and filling up arenas. And people wanted a show. And we've learned from that at Salem. We know live events work, and we do live events because Rush taught us the way. But U2 and Josh, put your finger on it. You got to be lighthearted. You got to have fun. People don't want to go to a funeral. I mean, we have to. We got to go to funerals. We got to show up and pay our respects. But we don't want to go to funerals. We want to go to parties. And the more Republicans that learn that, the better. And you guys are kind of showing the way there.
That's totally true, Hugh. And first of all, it's like beyond humbling to even be mentioned in the same sentence with yourself or Rush Limbaugh. We're clearly not there. But we do like to have fun. And I think the guiding principle of our podcast at the beginning was we're not going to scream at you and we're not going to read you the Federalist Papers, right? We're going to have a good time. We're going to contextualize this and what's happening based on what's happening in your life and how politics affects you. And then, we can play some games and sing some songs while we're at it. We're a variety program.
Wait a minute. Did you just slander the Federalist Papers?
Well, Smug has, for our April Fool's episode, he actually did read the Federalist Papers.
Oh, you're killing me. Larry Arnn is dying. Larry just had a stroke. He's listening. He's had a stroke. We're talking about the Federalist Papers tomorrow. Smug, tell me it's not true.
Well, I mean, here's the thing is I think there's a time and a place for intellectuals, and I appreciate the conservative intellectuals out there who especially involved with like judicial matters, making sure that those are taken care of. But I think right now what we need is a kind of brawny, ready to fight kind of conservatism. And our show presents that. Like, you know, when listeners, everyone, we've heard it so many times from people who tune in that listening to an episode of Ruthless is not like being lectured. It's like you said, it's not like being at a funeral. Listening to an episode of Ruthless is like hanging out with your friends. It's like grabbing beers with your buddies, having a good time. And I think an important part of that is that we don't try to debate the opposition because the ideas the left is presenting at this point are completely unserious. Defunding the police is completely unserious. So they shouldn't be debated. They should be mocked. And I think that's part of the success we've had is because the approach we take is we mock these people for their ridiculous ideas.
Let me play for you ridiculous idea number one from last night. Cut number 20, Generalissimo.
I stand here tonight, one day shy of the 100th day of my administration. 100 days since I took the oath of office and lifted my hand off our family Bible and inherited a nation, we all did, that was in crisis. The worst pandemic in a century. The worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War.
All right, stop right there. Gentlemen, I just had Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson on. He said he would have walked out at that moment. And he had heard me mention 9/11 and mention Pearl Harbor. He said, I'll add the sinking of the Lusitania if you want. What did you make of that last night, Smug?
So, I mean, I was incredibly offended to hear that. And I even sent up a tweet saying, you know, I'm certain the sailors at Pearl Harbor and the firefighters in New York City would strongly disagree with that sentiment.
100%. Josh?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. As Smug said, it's unserious from start to begin, from the beginning to end. I mean, all of the ideas espoused by the president last night and all the rhetoric used were geared towards fomenting this progressive base that he is somehow enraptured with and feels like he can govern it. And the reality is it's just, it's unpopular. It's going to be incredibly unpopular. I think it's inevitable that they are going to lose big in the midterms as a result of this agenda. And finally, it's just offensive. As Smug said, there's really no way to take that sentence and make it make sense.
Okay, so here's my concern for both of you. All of the woke guns on the left, if they have anybody in command who knows anything, are going to train them on you two. Because they have to wipe you out. They really do have to, because you're taking off and you're spreading. They're going to go after Charlie, but they're really going to go after you. Unfortunately, I think some of the never-Trumper irreconcilables, the Tories, have left for London and they're going to join. I hope the bridge is open to some of the never-Trumpers to come back in and join arms with you and become a party again. But what are you doing for defensible lines? Are you putting larder into the refrigerators? Are you storing up your powder? Because they're going to come for you too, Smug.
I mean, I would say for the past decade, I've been taking them on. I mean, if anyone has, Josh has seen them as well. I tell them it's a simple message. Bring it on. You know, the minions, as you mentioned, are an unparalleled force. Like, as hard as the left wants to push, we can push back 10 times harder.
Josh, you that level of confidence as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is the reality of being a high-profile conservative in today's America, right? You have the entire mainstream media against you. You have the entire higher education, pop culture, entertainment, Hollywood, you name it. Every single institution in this country, corporate America now increasingly, is against our ideas and our views. So if you make any sort of forward progress at all, they got you in the sights. The beauty of this is I've learned a little something from Mitch McConnell and the way he operates, and then if you stay focused on your goals and not what everybody else is saying, you have a tendency to be able to accomplish them. And I think we're headed in that direction. Lord knows we're standing on the shoulders of folks like you, Hugh, who have been doing this for longer than we have, and we're just trying to make a difference.
But you've got a producer. If I'd had a producer for 30 years, it would be much better off for me. Very quickly, I assume Ruthless Podcast is everywhere at iTunes, Spotify, wherever podcast. But if you're a Steelers fan, Smug, where do they find Ruthless?
I don't know. Do Steelers fans know how to use phones to begin with?
I'm not.
I'll just say go Broncos, and please, everyone give the show a listen. I think you'll love it.
Wait, what did you just say? What did you just say? Are you a Broncos fan?
Born in Denver, I had to be.
Delete the tape. Delete the tape. Oh, my God. Oh, I have been betrayed.
Said the Nixon worker.
Oh, my God. Oh, delete the tape. Other than that, Smug and Josh.
You got the NFL draft in Cleveland. You must
Oh, God, it happened to me. Oh, I have been betrayed. Et tu, Smug. All right, you two, be well. Ruthless podcast. I have been betrayed. Oh, treason. Treason. Did you know that, Generalissimo? Did you know that? We're not sending them any relief factor now. I was going to give these guys relief factor. We're not giving them a bag of relief factor. He snuck in a Broncos. Oh. Oh, you minions, you've been misled. Trust them on politics, not on football. Trust me on our sponsor, relieffactor.com. 1995. 3-week starter pack. Do not trust Smug and Ruthless. Ruthless and Josh. I'm completely discombobulated. I may have to turn the tribbles loose, but they blow away like dandelions in a hard wind compared to the minions. Suit up. Get your relief factor and go marching. Broncos fan. Phil Boyce will be happy. Nobody else will. Stay tuned, America. One more segment of today's Hugh Hewitt Show.